traveling all over. Yeah, hi Julie, good luck for your bar review. I hope you will make it and we'll be thinking about you. Yeah. We'll miss you, are missing you here. Hello. So, how is it?
Good. Do you have a look at this?
Yeah.
Is it okay? I think that's...
So what is happening is the special, is the, how do you call it? So the Rocky guy is coming.
Good afternoon. Can I ask people to take their seats now? We'll be starting in 1 minute. Good afternoon, everybody. I would like now to call the second meeting of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues is called to order. Please take your seats and maintain quiet and order in the room. Distinguished members of the forum. Can you please take your seats now and stop your conversations? We are going to start the meeting now. The second meeting of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues is called to order. Distinguished members of the forum, in accordance with the adopted program of work and as a follow-up to the recommendations of the Permanent Forum, we shall now proceed to deal with Agenda Item 3A, Economic and Social Development. We will hear the report of the expert group meeting on extractive industries, Indigenous people's rights and corporate responsibility, and the report of the Special Rapporteur on Indigenous peoples and corporations. After these reports, I will open the floor to the participants inscribed on the speaker's list to make their statements on these agenda items. If I hear no comments on the suggested program of work for this afternoon's meeting, I will then proceed to the report of the special rapporteurs first before I go into the report of the expert group meeting. I would like to request the special rapporteurs on corporations to take the floor now. And I would like to ask Ms. Elisa Kanki Molo, the distinguished member of the Permanent Forum, who is one of the special rapporteurs, to take the floor. You have the floor, Madam.
Gracias, señora presidenta.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Honorable representatives of governments, friends of international cooperation, dear brothers and sisters, the Napo River in the Amazon region of Peru is at present blocked and has been since April 9 in response to violations of rights by the petroleum industry and the government. This is only one of the many protests which the indigenous peoples of Peru and their organizations are developing against government policy. These policies are discriminate against us and threaten our territories, our very way of life. And they are an attempt against the entrenched rights of our peoples and not recognized by the government. This is only one sample of the constant violations of the rights of indigenous peoples by the logging industry. In the case of the Mapuche Forum in Chile, this led to hundreds of arrests, trials, and prison sentences. For the indigenous peoples, where mining companies have started their operations, like the Shoshone Nation of the United States, contamination of the environment and destruction of cultural sites has taken place. For we indigenous peoples, operations of petroleum companies, not only well drilling, but also other infrastructure, which supports the production and operation of these resources, also means the construction of installations of camps, of access roads and railways, which cut off natural river courses and fragment natural habitat for animals, as well as the community of indigenous peoples. These fragment the ecosystem. They change social, cultural aspects. They have a negative effect on food security and on our health. For the Hante in Russia, petroleum is a synonym of assimilation or exile, because they only have two options. Either joining the companies as workers on the bottom rung, or to leave their territory. Farming operations, fisheries, and biofuel operations have a very negative effect on the use of natural resources, especially when it comes to resources such as water and soil. Faced with these indigenous peoples, putting more and more pressure on the territories. Fisheries, in the case of Nicaragua, fortunately, the deputy minister of Nicaragua is here. What this has meant for the Miskito people of Nicaragua has been an early end to their working lives because of the onset of a syndrome of decompensation, the lack of security in their jobs for the major fishing industry. The use and the exploitation of traditional knowledge by pharmaceutical companies and cosmetic companies, through which indigenous people receive no benefits whatsoever, and who have the daring to patent these products as if they were their own discoveries, is just one of the many examples of the negative relationship between indigenous peoples and major corporations. But the most worrisome thing is that governments and states say that the rights of indigenous peoples are being recognized within national constitutions and public policies. Nevertheless, for indigenous peoples, what this relationship means is an indirect forced migration, an end to their working life, a premature one in the case of the Miskito people, the presence of all kinds of diseases such as cancer early disability, early loss of abilities, as well as vulnerabilities faced with other populations, and making them more and more prone to fall into the poorest sector of society. The number of indigenous peoples living under a system of patronage without a fair wage, constant pressure on their lands, the loss of their natural corridors for fishing, hunting, gathering, and agricultural activities, among others, are just some of the consequences. Today, this gives rise to ever-increasing concern. In the declaration made by the assistant to the office, to our office, they indicated that indigenous peoples are victims of development. And this is indeed true. We are more victims than beneficiaries. It is important for this space to be the space where all of us come together to find solutions over the long term. In this way, we can begin to understand that this is a dialogue between states and companies and indigenous peoples, because we have the right to be part of that negotiation. Many of the negotiations have taken place behind the backs of indigenous peoples, and they use and exploit the resources which we historically have defended. And this is a fundamental part of the very life of indigenous peoples. And this is the reason why it is so important for international cooperation and multilateral banks, which finance many of these projects, to enforce their public policies and the specific policies that safeguard these processes, and that these consultations be a procedure which is applied and which is triggered the minute a company wishes to initiate operations in indigenous territory. We have the right to say no. We have the right to say, let us work together, but never again without us, never again without the word of the indigenous peoples. When there is talk of making use of and exploiting the natural resources of indigenous people, we entreat those who are currently working on ISO 26000 for this instrument to be compulsory for businesses. This will be a demonstration that companies, corporations are becoming sensitive and they're opening their doors to indigenous peoples. If this is not the case, we will just continue negotiating this process, and states will be complicit. They will be the invisible accomplices to what is going on. And just to conclude, I would like to indicate that the projects of multinational and national corporations of whatever kind are the cause of major, severe problems in our lives. They interfere with our means of subsistence and our culture and our spiritual survival. For this reason, because of the structural injustices, cultural dissonance, discrimination, and political marginalization and exclusion, we have the right to fair compensation. Thank you very much.
Ms. Elisa Kankimolo, I would like to call now on Mr. Carlos. Mr. Carlos Mamani Condori, the distinguished member of the forum, also from Bolivia. You have the floor, Mr. Mamani.
Presidenta.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I would like to begin by congratulating you for upon your election as chair of this forum. And we wish to reiterate our commitment to continue working on the problems affecting indigenous peoples and the defense of their rights. Now, with regard to the issue at hand, we are still drafting the report of the research because it must be clear that we do have this report. We have very little support for our work. So we have to see what kind of resources we can get and how we can get enough time to do the work. Indigenous peoples, in my region in particular, face a relationship of inequity with the businesses which are extracting the resources on our lands, mining, hydrocarbon, forestry, hydroelectricity, and other resources. An important aspect of our relationship is that the presence of multinational companies is part of the it takes place in the framework of a colonial relationship. This colonial framework is a very long-standing one. And these colonial relations have not in the least changed relations either with corporations and, with a few exceptions, with states. In my region, there are many states signatory to international pacts, such as ILO Convention 169, and they supported the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. But these rights are very poorly known by the states and absolutely unknown to corporations. For example, in the Andes, Amazonia, Chaco region, what we see is the absence of any state presence and the invisibility of indigenous peoples. And what this leads to is an absence of rights, even though these peoples are historically and culturally indigenous. This is the case of Peru. In the case of Peru, they put this was questioned by the ombudsman, by those monitoring the implementation of ILO Convention 169 and members of Congress who are here and who will probably later bring up more specific examples. The impact that transnational corporations cause within this framework, especially those in the extractive industries, generates what we could call a new form of genocide. The impact, then, we have been able to establish have to do with the deterioration of living conditions because they eliminate the means of subsistence, economic means of communities without providing any alternatives. The transnational companies operating in our territory compete with indigenous peoples for access to natural resources, or they simply make it impossible to access them. In the case of mining companies, for example, which move more than 45 million tons of land of earth every day and which need large stretches of land to dump this land on and also interfere with access to grazing land, to water, and even to drinking water. There's also violence and deprivation of fundamental liberties through the security apparatus of these corporations. This is expressed in intimidation, torture, kidnapping, forcible arrest, disappearance, and even murder of our people. Protest has been criminalized in some Latin American countries with the jailing of activists, the passage of anti-activism laws, and other measures. The deterioration of local traditions, which lead to a loss of cultural identity, traditional values, the dignity of our own language and customs, etc. There's the profanation of sacred sites, sanctuaries, and cemeteries, which generate irremediable trauma in the lives of indigenous peoples. The violation of our territories by people who are alien to our culture and extraction. The building of plants is accompanied by alcoholism, drug addiction, prostitution, violence, destructuring of the family because the increasing number of single mothers, which all have to be responded to. There are internal divisions instigated by corporations in order to further their own interests in exploiting resources. In many countries in the region, in Peru and Ecuador, what these companies do is to divide the indigenous communities and organizations and work with the so-called parallel organizations. They create parallelism both in indigenous organizations and authorities. Lack of knowledge of our traditional culture violates our internal standards, our families, our symbols, and our administration of states. Families have been expelled from their lands. This has led to degradation of the soil, affecting the means of subsistence of their peoples. Explosions and detonations lead to animals fleeing and affect surface water. This is caused by petroleum and gas exploring companies. They also increase the rate of climate change because of pollution and the use of fossil fuels in their operations. Corporate responsibility, with some exceptions, is a public relations exercise, which only serves to cover up the corporate culture. They develop a series of assistance policies in order to make up from the absence of the state, and they establish funds which are managed by the offices of so-called corporate social responsibility, or foundations which corporations establish but which are never managed by indigenous peoples or organizations. There is also a lack of international standards. Standards are fragmented and are not applied in a real fashion, so we need a set of standards across the board. Countries which do not have such standards need to be able to call on international ones. National and international conflict resolution mechanisms, laws protecting the rights of indigenous peoples and regulating the access to resources, which are inconsistent, as well as the implementation of the human rights of indigenous peoples. It's either not enough or is simply ignored. Because of the so-called corporate social responsibility, as well as the standards of the IMF and the IDB, well, what we're aware of is that these standards are not helping indigenous people in their struggle to have their rights and territories recognized. We therefore call on governments and international organizations and agencies to set up mechanisms which will bind corporations, forums for consultation with the affected people, so that indigenous peoples can effectively participate in decision-making about their territory and resources. And this must be very clear, because we now have in the framework of the declaration the right to free self-determination. Along with this right, there is a prior free and informed consent, which is a fundamental right to be taken into account when indigenous peoples participate in treaties, consultations, agreement with state and private entities, and with reference to the rights of their soil and natural resources. The Vienna Declaration and Program of Action, Parts 1 and 2, Paragraphs 20 and 30 respectively, also recognize the importance of free and informed participation of indigenous peoples on issues that affect us as a way of contributing to their rights and well-being. Now, with regard to corporations, prior free informed consent is of the greatest importance, since it calls for monitoring and review processes of the consultations, as well as full development of these consultations with indigenous peoples with regard to their acceptance of these projects, as well as the distribution of profits generated and mitigation process in case of negative impacts. Now, in the framework of these findings, allow me to recommend that as part of the permanent forum, we should work on establishing guidelines for the effective exercise of free prior informed consent whenever corporations or states plan to conduct operations in our territories. Since we have been able to demonstrate the weakness of states in the cases of Bolivia or Peru, or the absence of a state, as in the case of Peru, we have to set up guidelines to defend indigenous peoples against states so that violations by mission or commission, either by states or transnational corporations, will not go unpunished, and so structures which will make it possible to fully enjoy our rights be established. Thank you. Now, with a need to develop learning on the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and the difficulties in the application of ILO Convention 169, our rights have to be audited and guidelines should be established to make up for the damage caused, establishing how corporate practices should be guided in the future and how damage should be made up for. The legal services provided by states to indigenous peoples with regard to their territories. I was referring to the case of Bolivia earlier. This is the area where we have the largest gas and oil fields in my country, but indigenous people still do not have title to their lands, lands which their communities have held for centuries, and there are much worse situations in other regions of the world, so this is a very important topic. The operations of transnational corporations are not being regulated, and they take place within a framework of goodwill, which frees them of their direct responsibility when it comes to generating impacts which are violations of the human rights of indigenous peoples. We must therefore consider the need for the voluntary respect for the rights of indigenous peoples, and this should be used as a means of making transnational corporations accountable. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Carlos Mamani. I now call on distinguished member of the forum, Mr. Pavel Sulianziga. Pavel, you have the floor.
Спасибо большое, Вики.
Thank you very much, Vicky. I would also like to join in with those who congratulated you on being elected to chair our proceedings. And what I would like to say is as follows. My considerations in writing will be submitted to the 9th session of the Permanent Forum. When we worked on the study of the relationship between the indigenous peoples and the corporations, myself and many of my colleagues underscored the interrelationship between the indigenous peoples and major companies which are working on mineral resources such as oil, gas, gold, diamonds, etc., many other very important minerals. But as we went on working on this topic in my country, in the Russian Federation, we realized that we had a separate major issue, which was the interrelationship between the indigenous people and the private business entities, which are also working in the same natural resource area, but they work on bioresources. And here we are talking about fisheries, hunting, tourism, and gathering. And this is a major separate topic on which I will dwell a bit later. Now, as regards the issue of the interrelationship between the indigenous people and the corporations which work in the area of oil, gas, and other natural resources here, I would like to say the following. As you all recall, my country, in 2007, we had an international seminar with all of the members of the Permanent Forum participated, and the topic was the indigenous peoples and corporations. In December 2008, together with the United Nations High Commission on Human Rights Office, we convened a seminar where we looked at the experience garnered in North America, Africa, Russian Federation, and Oceania on that specific topic as well. And I must say that at present, the government of the Russian Federation is working on the standards for the interrelationships between indigenous peoples and corporations. A number of corporations, under their own initiatives, stand ready, and some signed agreements with indigenous peoples in which they undertake, they commit themselves to respect the rights of the indigenous peoples, not only in line with what we have in our national legislation, but also on the basis of the international standards of indigenous peoples' rights. Also, I would like to inform you the international financial corporations is a very good incentive which moves corporations towards working with indigenous peoples. And in this regard, please allow me to mention the most recent document on indigenous peoples, which was passed by the European Bank on Reconstruction and Development. Their policy, the EBRD, includes a provision on free, prior, and informed consent from indigenous peoples. Having lifted this language from the United Nations Declaration on Indigenous Peoples' Rights, whole cloth. Another point that I wanted to underline here is the fact that those corporations which come to the Russian Federation and start developing natural resources, very frequently they have Western management at the top, and this provides the indigenous people to conduct negotiations with them at a dignified level. The Canadian company, for example, which works in the Chukotka area, has signed a special agreement with the indigenous peoples in having undertaken additional commitments vis-a-vis those indigenous peoples whose interests their work affects. At the same time, unfortunately, I must acknowledge that in my country, what I mentioned early in my statement did not become prevalent system-wide. Many companies, many corporations which acknowledge indigenous people's rights and who work with them at the level of international standards in one region behave in a certain way and in a completely different way in another region. In other words, what we have is that until and unless pressure is exerted on them, they do not voluntarily go towards protecting indigenous people's rights. Now, separate topic is the private companies which are involved in fishing, hunting, gathering, etc. In other words, those areas of activities where the indigenous peoples themselves are active. Recently in my country, and this is very unfortunate, private companies who work in those areas is edging out the indigenous peoples from their traditional areas. And I'm not here talking about our communities being resettled away from where we used to live, and our fishing grounds and hunting grounds are being taken away. Let me give you the example of Kamchatka. There was a law on fisheries passed, and then there were tenders submitted for fishing grounds, and the indigenous peoples, of course, obviously received a certain number of fishing grounds. They were not completely left destitute. But there's another very telling example there. There is a village called Kavram in Kamchatka. And there is a river flowing nearby. This River is given over to a commercial fishing entity, which is not located in this village, it's located elsewhere. And the community which lives in the village is being asked to go fishing elsewhere, in another area, in another river. Clearly, this community is not going to go elsewhere away from where they're located. And obviously, they're going to continue fishing in those in the self-same river. So they are compelled to be acting against the law. And this is only one example, and similar examples can be found elsewhere in the country. In the Primorye region, for example, where hunting grounds were auctioned off to non-indigenous entities. Before coming here, we received a letter from the Magadansk region, where the Indigenous Peoples Associations wrote a letter to the president of the Russian Federation asking him for help in protecting their own hunting grounds. And to our great regret, such regions, which such as Yamal-Nenets region and Hantimansik region, which used to do very, very well, were there as well because of the new law on fisheries. We notice that mass violations of indigenous people's rights to their fishing grounds are being registered. I am of the view that our forum did a very good thing when they decided that this topic of ours is going to be one of our main topics in order to protect the rights of indigenous peoples. And I do hope that the studies that we are conducting within the forum will be helpful to us in protecting the indigenous peoples' rights and coming up with recommendations at both international and national levels to help us protect the indigenous peoples' rights to their traditional areas and their traditional way of life. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, my distinguished colleague Pavel Solyansiga. I would like now to give a brief report on the expert group meeting on extractive industries, indigenous people's rights, and corporate social responsibility. This is contained in document E/C19/2009/conference room paper, CRP 8. I would like to apologize that this is just in English because the workshop just finished in the first week of May, and there was no time to have the report translated in the languages. So I'll go through some of the highlights of this extractive industries expert group meeting and end up with some recommendations that emerge from this. I will not go through the whole report with the hope that you will be able to find some time to also look at this. First of all, if you remember, last year there was a recommendation in paragraph 72 of the report of the seventh session of the Permanent Forum, and this paragraph states that the Permanent Forum decides to authorize a three-day international expert group workshop on indigenous people's rights, corporate accountability, and the extractive industries, and requests that the results of the meeting be reported to the forum at its eighth session in 2009, and that the report of this workshop can feed into the 18th and 19th session of the Commission on Sustainable Development, which will address the themes of mining, chemicals, waste management, and sustainable consumption and production patterns, and contribute to the review by the 18th session of the Commission. So this was a resolution which recognized that there are these forthcoming activities, and therefore we have to provide some recommendations for these activities. Let me thank first the Norwegian Agency for Development Corporation and the Christensen Fund for supporting, giving funds for this expert workshop group to take place. These funders also provided enough money for us to hold a three-day international conference on indigenous peoples and extractive industries, which preceded this expert group meeting. The international conference had a number, had 100 indigenous representatives from all of the 7 regions of the permanent forum, and all these people came from 35 countries all over the world. So this conference came up with a Manila Declaration, which is appended to the report of this expert group meeting. In the expert group meeting, we had representatives from indigenous peoples, again from the 7 regions, from UN agencies, bodies and funds, which include some international financial institutions like the Asian Development Bank and the International Finance Corporation of the World Bank Group. We tried to invite corporations to come. We invited the International Council on Metals and Minerals, but none of them sent any of their representatives. Nevertheless, this report is going to go to be submitted to them also. So just very briefly, I would just like to say that in the program of work, we looked at all the different actors and their roles in terms of extractive industries, and we limited the discussion on oil, gas, and mineral extraction. We look at the role of corporations, and in our report, we highlighted that according to the provisions of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, extractive industries must not operate on indigenous lands or territories without obtaining the free, prior, and informed consent of the relevant communities and indigenous peoples. This includes the right to say no to extraction or exploration. We stress that FPIC is a right and not an obligation, and it is therefore for indigenous peoples to determine whether they will engage in discussions or not. And we also stress that free prior informed consent is not a single decision, but rather a process that occurs in stages and which can be revoked. In our report, we also the participants also expressed concern that all the corporations were now more flexible in terms of benefit sharing due to the pressures and struggles of indigenous peoples. There was no increased interest in acknowledging the sovereignty of traditional decision-making of indigenous peoples and their rights to their territory, or in redressing past human rights abuses. It was as though corporations believed they could solve all problems associated with extractive industries through mere financial compensation. Moreover, payments to indigenous communities often had negative impacts on the community and were divisive. In some instances, corporations created NGOs to implement so-called development projects in indigenous people's communities with the ultimate goal of gaining the support of these communities. However, these processes and the use of financial or tangible benefits resources were generally not transparent. When this occurs prior to obtaining consent, it is regarded by many as undue influence and even bribery. Participants stressed that although the concept of best practices or good practices is frequently used in the context of extractive industries and indigenous peoples, the term remained abstract as concrete examples were rarely presented. In instances where cases were offered, they were lacking in detail and therefore inadequate for use as examples for emulations by other companies. Further discussion was required to determine the factors that would constitute a good practice. The participants also stressed the need for transparency on the part of extractive industries. Although the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative had been established to address this concern, it focuses on financial transparency and does not include transparency with regard to environmental, social, cultural, and economic impacts of extractive industries on indigenous peoples. A lack of transparency in these areas facilitated the spreading of misinformation. For example, corporations often argued that they offered economic benefits to indigenous communities in the form of job creation. In fact, extractive industries often result in a net job loss, particularly for indigenous peoples, because they are not offered jobs by the company and their original livelihoods are impacted or lost due to environmental contamination and forced displacement. In addition, those subjected to scrutiny by the initiative are only those who have formally applied to be part of this. And as of now, there are very few members of the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative. Extractive industries corporations generally fail to comply with national laws that protect the rights of indigenous peoples. It was emphasized that this was occurring on a global basis, regardless of a state's developed or developing status, and regardless of the state's industrialized political or economic status. Participants expressed concern that corporations were even less likely to respect the rights of indigenous peoples in countries where the state itself showed little respect for their rights or where the state maintained close relations with extractive industries. Extractive industries were also seen to be complicit in the formulation of policies and laws that diminished the rights of indigenous peoples. Most national laws on mineral, oil, and gas extraction were made without consultations with indigenous peoples, and many of these contradicted or undermined indigenous peoples' rights. In particular, the failure to adequately protect spiritual areas commonly referred to as sacred sites. In terms of the role of indigenous organizations, participants also stated there is often a misconception that indigenous peoples from developed states share in the wealth of their states or are otherwise in a different position than other indigenous peoples. This was shown generally not to be the case. For example, socioeconomic indicators regarding indigenous peoples in developed states demonstrated the urgent need for attention to the rights to lands, territories, and resources, the rights to self-determination, and the rights to health, culture, as well as issues relating to criminal justice systems and other concerns. The plight of indigenous peoples in developed states is generally not addressed by the UN, except by the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues and the Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms of Indigenous Peoples. It is important to recognize that indigenous peoples from these states require international assistance, including capacity building and funding. In terms of the role of the states, the participants stressed that in some states where constitutional and legislative protection have been afforded to indigenous peoples' rights, examples were shared on the roles played by the extractive industries in shaping the associated implementing rules and regulations, for example, guidelines related to FPIC. This led to guidelines which are very insensitive to indigenous peoples' cultures and traditional systems of decision-making and made it easier for corporations to manipulate and divide the indigenous communities between themselves. Indigenous peoples face significant barriers in accessing domestic courts. First, most of them barely have resources to ensure their basic survival, much less to bring the cases to court. Secondly, members of the judiciary in many countries are bribed by corporations and are threatened or killed if they rule in favor of indigenous peoples. States have an obligation to provide indigenous peoples with better access to justice and maintain independent judiciary systems. In terms of home state responsibility to regulate transnational corporate behavior, it was highlighted that home states' obligations under international law include the duty to exercise extraterritorial jurisdiction over corporate activities. This includes, in particular, the minimum standards set forth in the UN Declaration and obligation set forth by the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination and other international human rights laws. It was noted favorably that the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination has in two instances issued specific recommendations to state parties underscoring their obligations under the convention with respect to the activities of their corporations outside of their borders. We also look at the role of the UN in the international financial institutions, and the participants said that UN agencies generally offer technical assistance to governments and rarely to indigenous communities and organizations. And therefore, UN agencies should expand their technical assistance to include indigenous peoples. As the impacts of extractive industries are both serious and controversial sources of credible independent information, and assessment are essential to the protection of indigenous peoples' rights, the permanent forum, the expert mechanism, the special rapporteur, and other UN agencies and bodies should help remedy this situation by working with indigenous peoples to research and document the impacts of mining and other extractive industries. It is also important that the WHO study and document the health impacts of extractive industries on indigenous peoples, and that UNESCO should also study the roles played by extractive industries in destroying sacred, cultural, religious, spiritual heritage sites of indigenous peoples. We also would like to stress that indigenous peoples, again, do not have access to domestic courts, and the international system could not cope with the existing volumes of egregious cases. Given the catastrophic impacts that extractive industries have on indigenous communities around the world, participants called for a few formal processes such as an ombudsman or an international court system specifically focused on these issues. Finally, participants expressed concern on the significant increase of money allotted by the International Finance Corporation for extractive industries and hydroelectric dam projects. This poses serious threats to indigenous peoples whose lands and territories are being eyed by the industry for extraction. We now go to the, we have many recommendations that we have cited in the expert group meeting. I will just like to highlight a few. In terms of recommendation to the corporations, we recommended that there should be a recognition of the rights of indigenous peoples over their lands as the basis for negotiations over proposed extractive industries, as well as the organization of engagement, partnership, and sharing of financial benefits. In instances where indigenous peoples consent to extractive industries, payments or benefit sharing arrangements should be based on annual reviews throughout the life of the activity. Incomes from any extractive industry must cover all costs associated with closure and restoration and include sufficient funds to provide for potential future liabilities. It was also stressed that corporations should be accountable to indigenous peoples for damages resulting from past extractive industries activities that affected their lands and livelihoods, and provide compensation and restitution for damages inflicted upon the lands, territories, and resources of indigenous peoples. In relation to recommendations for the for indigenous peoples, there were lots of recommendations in terms of how indigenous peoples can use existing treaty bodies and also strengthening solidarity with each other. In relation to the states, we reiterated that the UN Declaration should be endorsed and the ratification of ILO Convention 169 should take place in more countries. There was also a recommendation to review laws and policies and structures on extractive industries that are detrimental to indigenous people and ensure consistency with the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Of course, the free prior informed consent was stressed several times over, and not free prior and informed consultation. We have several recommendations to the international financial institutions and also to the corporations, and we actually specifically requested the International Council on Mining and Metals to provide a list of 10 projects that they recommend as best practices, and this list should be accompanied by an open invitation for the members of the forum to visit, have access to project sites and files. We requested the Global Compact to participate in meetings of the forum so they can share examples of good practices received from their members. And we also advocate that the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative Secretariat, which is based in Norway, should coordinate an effective strategy to ensure that environmental and social impacts on indigenous communities are considered part of the transparency protocols that are to be prepared by governments that are certified under this initiative. Finally, we just highlighted again a lot of the recommendations for international financial institutions, and we stress that the IFI should recognize and enforce the rights of indigenous peoples to free prior informed consent as laid out in the UN Declaration, as opposed to the weaker approach, which is consultation. And we also said that they should review their policies, standards, and guidelines to ensure that these conform with current minimum standards and law and embody the UN Declaration. So these are some of the recommendations from the meeting. There were several members of the permanent forum who were there. There were, I think, five of us, Ms. Kanki, Ms. Carlos Mamani, Peymane Haste, and myself. And we are this report is going to be discussed by the forum as far as its recommendations are concerned. So this can be reiterated again in the recommendation part of the session. So this is the report of the expert group. And we also have the Manila Declaration, which is part of the submission by the International Conference to the expert group meeting. Thank you very much. So we can now open up the floor for questions and statements by the observers. And I would first like to invite the speaker who will speak on behalf of the Global Indigenous Peoples Caucus, Mikiala Catalfano. Mikiala Catalfano, you have the floor. Yes, you have the floor. You press the button, yes.
Indigenous peoples and nations from all regions of the world who participated in the Global Indigenous Peoples Caucus for the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues 8th Session reflected on a range of serious considerations and situations presented in our meeting. This year's Permanent Forum session places special emphasis on implementation and detailed review of the Permanent Forum's previous recommendations. In this regard, we urge the Permanent Forum to take note of the following critical concerns of Indigenous peoples of the world. Regarding Agenda Item 3 on Economic and Social Development, 1, we reaffirm support for the call to reduce the number of recommendations. 2, we urge the development of a mechanism to support Indigenous peoples' incorporation of distinct indicators of human development that would include legally recognized access to land and territory. Regarding Agenda Item 3 on the second International Decade of World Indigenous Peoples, we propose that the Permanent Forum call upon the Economic and Social Council to present to the United Nations General Assembly that the title, which currently reads Second International Decade of World's Indigenous People, be corrected to read Second International Decade of World's Indigenous Peoples. 2, we urge the Permanent Forum to join the Global Stop TB Partnership and to support the Global Indigenous Stop TB Strategic Plan to address the tuberculosis crisis in Indigenous communities. 3, we reiterate the rights affirmed in the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples be applied as the operative framework and criteria for carrying out the program of action for the second International Decade of the World's Indigenous Peoples, in particular its objective calling for free, prior, and informed consent by indigenous peoples. 4, we recommend that the Permanent Forum carry out a study assessing the implementation of the Millennium Development Goals, recognizing and respecting the principles of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, notwithstanding the global economic crisis, to be presented at its 9th session. 5, we urge the Permanent Forum to call upon the United Nations General Assembly to declare 2010 the year of food sovereignty with the full and effective participation of Indigenous peoples. 6, we urge member states that any and all free trade agreements must recognize, respect, and implement mechanisms for the protection of the rights contained in the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. 7, we recognize and commend Colombia and Australia for changing their positions by endorsing the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. We call upon the 3 remaining states that oppose, as well as those abstaining, to reverse their positions and move to endorse the Declaration for full consensus. 8, we urge the Permanent Forum to call upon the member states to respect the rights to land and territory for nomadic, uncontacted, and displaced indigenous peoples, as well as those indigenous peoples in voluntary isolation and those facing extinction. 9, we reiterate our call to the United Nations to create an official United Nations archive of treaties, agreements, and constructive arrangements between indigenous peoples and nation states. We also urge indigenous peoples to bring all treaties to the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Peoples' 9th session to begin the process of compiling the archives. Regarding Agenda Item 4 on human rights, 1, we call upon the Permanent Forum to urge all state parties to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, as well as indigenous peoples, to apply the CRC General Comment Number 11 as a guide in implementing their obligations. 2, we call upon the Permanent Forum to endorse and adopt the attached proposed resolution that we respectfully submit on the rights of the Indigenous child to health and education pursuant to the resolution adopted by the UN General Assembly's 63rd session. 3, we request that the Permanent Forum recommend the United Nations Human Rights Council authorize and request the expert mechanism on the rights of Indigenous peoples to conduct a study on the right to health of indigenous peoples to be initiated at its 2nd session in August 2009. 4, recognizing the independent expert on the issue of human rights obligations related to access to safe drinking water and sanitation, we urge the Permanent Forum to call upon the Human Rights Council to expand the mandate to work with the United Nations Environmental Program for an international study on water that extends beyond drinking water to include spiritual sustenance and cultural livelihoods. 5, we call upon the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms of Indigenous Peoples to conduct an investigation on human rights impacts of mega-development projects, including the desecration of sacred sites and militarization upon the request of the affected Indigenous Peoples. 6, we urge that the chewing of coca leaf be removed from the United Nations Vienna Convention Against Illicit Drug Trafficking, because it is an integral part of the culture of various indigenous peoples and serves positive therapeutic, sacred, and social functions. 7, we recommend that the Permanent Forum urge the Human Rights Council to address the human rights violations of indigenous peoples impacted by international borders, immigration laws, and enforcement policies. 8, we strongly endorse the recommendations made to the upcoming United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, COP15, and the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization in the Anchorage Declaration of April 24, along with the recommendations submitted on May 8 to the High-Level Stockholm Convention, COP4, by the Indigenous Peoples Caucus to increase and ensure Indigenous peoples' formal participation in these processes. 9, we recommend that the Permanent Forum urge member states to present their plans of action for the full implementation, monitoring, and evaluation of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples at each session of the Permanent Forum. 10, we commend the General Assembly on their declaration of April 22nd as the International Day of Mother Earth. We call upon member states to begin negotiations on a convention on the rights of Mother Earth with the full participation of Indigenous peoples. 11, we urge the Permanent Forum to call upon member states to decriminalize Indigenous peoples struggling for justice and their rights, and to discontinue labeling them as terrorists. 12, finally, we endorse the declaration and plan of action from the 3rd Indigenous Leaders Summit of the Americas held in Panama, April 14th through 15th, and call for their implementation. Madam Chair, esteemed members of the Permanent Forum, brothers and sisters, in conclusion, we affirm that the adoption of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples establishes a new framework of evaluation for the work of the Permanent Forum and all initiatives of the United Nations system. It is a necessary instrument to address the global crisis as a mechanism of world peace. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Nikki Ala Catalfano, who spoke on behalf of the Global Indigenous Peoples Caucus. I would like now to call on the representative of the observer government of Brazil, Mr. Marcio Augusto Freitas de Meira, the president of the Brazilian National Foundation for Indigenous Issues. And after him, I would like to call on UNESCO to speak on behalf of the Interagency Support Group. Mr. Marcio Augusto Freitas de Meira, you have the floor, sir.
Madame la Présidente, je vais dire bonjour.
Madam Chairperson, I would like to say hello to representatives of states, leaders of states, representatives of indigenous organizations, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for the invitation to the 8th session of the Permanent Forum of the United Nations on Indigenous Issues, which is very important. I thank you also for the opportunity to explain to the world the policy we pursue in Brazil when it comes to the indigenous peoples. The organization of the Brazilian state is a public institution, and it's 42 years old now, and it stems from another tradition, the indigenous tradition in Brazil, which is more than 100 years old. It's the former SPE. As the head of this institution, we do not forget the traditions pursued by those who created the tradition of indigenous peoples in Brazil since 1926. We have to cultivate this memory if we are to have all of the necessary conditions in order to move forward and to be even more effective in making sure that we improve the life of the indigenous Indian people in Brazil. Of course, things have changed over the past 100 years, but our indigenous peoples also changed and created a new relationships with the Brazilian state. President Lula, as soon as he came into office in Brazil in 2003, he told us what is our main goal is to be a strong institution capable of conducting a dialogue with the indigenous people under the conditions stipulated in our constitution and other international instruments to which we are signatories. For example, the Convention 169 and the United Nations Declaration. We have the recent example. It was the decision in March 2009 of the Supreme Court, which concluded on the issue of the compatibility between sovereign responsibility and the indigenous people's right to land. For us, the recognition of the demarcation of traditional Indian territories is a priority issue. It has been for decades. In regional governments, over the past 20 years, the role of state in conducting social policy in Funai is that it's not to play a predominant, the strongest role. A concept here is that other stakeholders of the civil society can also fulfill this role. We, representatives of President Lula's government view things differently. We think that we need to meet the need of 150,000 Indian people in Brazil who speak 148 different languages, which have been identified, who live over 656 recognized territories, which represent 170 million hectares, which is about 13% of the national territory. We in Brazil realize that Indians need a strong institution, policy aimed at diversification, enabling them to resist as they have been resisting through the history of Brazil. 2 years ago, the National Commission on Indigenous Issues Policy, CNPE, which was created by President Lula, and this was an important step in consolidating our policy towards the indigenous peoples, and was also a reaction to the indigenous peoples movement. The existing indigenous entities have been asking for the creation of a council of indigenous peoples to be able to conduct a dialogue and define which policies need to be pursued. What are the new things that CNP brings into this? It's the active participation of elected Indian representatives in the five geographical regions of Brazil, parity constitutions, discussions with government on public policy vis-a-vis this population that the government has to implement and that the indigenous peoples have the right to follow, assess, and discuss with the government. It is an important step in developing further our indigenous peoples' policies. So this is our reformulation of the concept that we have within our body in line with the Constitution, which recognizes that the Brazilian state has a very clear duty to promote social rights for the indigenous peoples and to foster these rights on the basis of territorial claims and affirmation of other rights. In Brazil today, we have activities undertaken by the states which are exclusive to FUNAI, which will continue to be so. For example, the demarcation of indigenous areas. And there are many others which aren't. For example, health policy, education policy. However, FUNAI is a coordinating role when it comes to the indigenous issues policy through the programs which promote and protect the indigenous people, which are made explicitly in a multi-annual plan of the Brazilian government for 2008-2011. Our constitution very clearly states that our indigenous people have every possibility to go to courts, to create indigenous peoples' associations, to get in contact with companies, to promote traditional economic activities, establish their own business relationship, to run and be elected. There are several mayors and members of council who are indigenous who have been elected recently. Their protection is a duty of our state and will continue to be so because the indigenous peoples are culturally different. Their customs and traditions are different and their rights have to be protected, and this protection is the state's duty. We have to guarantee this. But this doesn't mean that the state is to decide instead of the indigenous peoples themselves, that we have to guide them in an authoritative manner. We're talking about different people, different languages, different cultures, which also have a historic relationship with the state, and that also has to be respected. Indigenous education in my country is something that's been discussed currently. We have a national conference undergoing right now in Brazil. And as we convene regional conference, and that took place all over the country, they also participated in the deliberations of our commission. It's been years that the indigenous peoples wanted to convene such conferences and discuss the policy vis-à-vis the indigenous people. And this will be culminated in the national conference, which took place in September 2009. The Constitution states that the indigenous peoples have the right to school education in a different manner, which uses all of their traditional customs and traditions. This includes their native tongue, but also including getting knowledge to the full complement of our culture. Other social programs of the government include, for example, fellowships to families, and this is aimed at reducing social differences through income redistribution. And through doing this, we are promoting citizenship. We had asked the following question before. Do the indigenous peoples have the right to receive such family allowances? Well, yes, they do. But from their viewpoint, the cultural difference has to be the priority element, and they have not to be looked at from the viewpoint of exclusion only. The question, therefore, now is as follows. How do we define the criteria for redistribution to indigenous people while respecting their traditions, customs, culture, and language to make sure that the indigenous family can receive allowances without being considered poor? The main question here, and we understand that Indians are not poor. This is a wrong concept. You can have indigenous communities which became poor, economically speaking, because of the pressure which is being exerted by surrounding society. This is a specific situation which has to be dealt with in its specificity. What our society has is prejudices to think that people who do not fulfill certain criteria are considered poor. There is another concept. We have to promote social inclusion of the indigenous people. But that may be wrong, too. They're not necessarily excluded. They don't need to be included in any kind of society because they already have theirs. They have their society. They are a people. They are not poor. They have another way of interacting with the environment, another way of conducting economic activities, another way of creating their own societies. The indigenous people have their way of socially organizing themselves, which creates a certain way of relating to the environment, to nature, which is part and parcel of their culture and which have been recognized constitutionally. The important thing here is to make sure that we can face the new social forms on the basis of customary traditions and customs of the indigenous people. Against this background, it's important to underscore the civil registration, which has to take place to make sure that all of the indigenous people have the right to be consulted when economic development activities are being in question, and also they have the right to use the fruits of such development, the right to health, public and free, have the right to participate in the political right, that we have to respect the rights of indigenous people's children, their youth, their right to sustainably produce and regenerate their way of life, the right to community life, which is the cultural expression. But this demands that there's indigenous participation in social control. Citizenship programs launched by the government in 2007, in particular for the indigenous areas, have to be considered as an innovative example of how to implement policies through action and interaction in an integrated manner to make sure that public investment goes to these areas. And this is defined on the basis of socioeconomic criteria. And in this prospect, a new way of public management has to be created where the democratization of public expenditure has to guide management. we have to move towards a new way of promoting dialogue. How are these people to develop? How are we to guarantee that there is a dialogue, that there is partnership with the state and civil society? We expect that our challenge will be exactly that new relationship, by creating a new concept for this relationship. We do have an opportunity to change, and we should not let this opportunity pass us by and change our view as a state. I'm talking about a new relationship between the state and the indigenous people, considering that we are talking about a culturally different entity. There are different customs, there are different traditions, and their rights have to be protected, and this protection is the state's duty if we are to provide them with all of their rights. This does not mean that the state has to decide for the indigenous people and take decisions in their place. They are different. They have different languages, different cultures, and their history is different from ours.
Their statement now.
Je conclue.
Yes, I'm wrapping up. And they are worthy of our respect. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, the distinguished observer of the government of Brazil. Before I call on the next speaker, I would like to remind, with due respect to all of you, I would like to remind that we will apply the 5-minute rule to all of the speakers, particularly the collective statements of indigenous peoples, the UN agencies, and the government. So all of you are equally allotted that amount of time. So please try to keep with it that time limit. We will use the machine now so that you will see when you need to conclude your statement. I would like to call now on the representative of the Interagency Support Group on Indigenous Peoples, the chair for the last year's meeting, UNESCO, and this is Mr. Douglas Nakashima. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. The 2008... First, let me address to the distinguished members of the forum, Indigenous representatives, excellencies, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen. The 2008 annual meeting of the UN Interagency Support Group on Indigenous Peoples Issues was held at UNESCO headquarters in Paris, France, from 15 to 17 September 2008, just 1 year after the historic adoption of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. 23 agencies and programs from the UN and other intergovernmental bodies participated in the meeting that was also coupled with the first official visit of the Permanent Forum to UNESCO. 3 Permanent Forum members participated in the meeting and the visit, namely Victoria Tolikopoulos, Margaret Lokawua, Carlos Mamami Kondori. This formula pairing the annual interagency support group meeting with an official visit of the Permanent Forum to the host agency is one that has been used successfully in the past and proved once more very constructive in the case of UNESCO. It allows not only a reinforcement of ties amongst the agencies in their pursuit of joint work on indigenous issues, but the dual presence of the Permanent Forum and a multitude of agencies is in itself an important awareness-raising mechanism for the senior management and staff of the host organization. To take full advantage of this unique opportunity, a roundtable was organized on development with culture and identity in light of the 2007 UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. This tied into the current agenda of the support group and the forum and directly involved both permanent forum and support group members. Turning to the support group meeting per se, this year's meeting had 2 main objectives. The first was to deepen reflection on Indigenous peoples' concepts of development, as captured by the term development with culture and identity, in view of preparing a joint interagency contribution to the next 2010 session of the Permanent Forum. The second objective was to explore ways and means to reinforce joint UN action for the promotion of the rights and aspirations of Indigenous peoples, notably at regional and country levels. In addition, the support group discuss modalities to strengthen the support to the work of the permanent forum, including its contribution to the 2009 session. With respect to the objective Indigenous peoples' development with culture and identity, the theme that will be the focus of the ninth session of the permanent forum in 2010 was put forward by the permanent forum and refers to development as conceived by Indigenous peoples themselves. It takes as its primary reference the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, in particular Article 3 and 23. The support group discussed this theme as a further step in its preparation of a joint interagency contribution to that 2010 session of the permanent forum. Several points can be highlighted from debates at the roundtable and sessions of the support group. It was recognized that the concept of development with culture and identity calls for a major rethinking of mainstream development paradigms. It was also underlined that the concept is necessarily rooted in a rights-based approach. To advance towards the ambitious goal of development with culture and identity, it requires work at all levels, globally, regionally, and locally. There will be a need for a deeper understanding of local realities by all stakeholders as a prerequisite to design culturally appropriate strategies. Indigenous peoples would need to assume an active and central role that moves beyond current participatory and consultative processes with direct representation in decision-making mechanisms. Several agencies presented recent and ongoing work that could provide a foundation and springboard for advancing the concept of development with culture and identity and furthering its implementation on the ground. Following these exploratory discussions, the support group agreed to work on a joint reflection paper on the concept and practices of development with culture and identity as they relate to UN work with Indigenous peoples. This paper will be presented at the ninth session of the Permanent Forum in 2010. With respect to joint UN action in support of Indigenous peoples' issues at regional and country level, the UNDG guidelines on Indigenous peoples' issues were elaborated by the support group to orient UN country teams and ensure that their work promotes the rights and aspirations of Indigenous peoples. These guidelines were adopted by the UNDG group in 2008. The support group discussed further measures that need to be taken to ensure that the UNDG guidelines are taken into account and successfully integrated into practice at the country level. With respect to capacity building, this is an essential element of the plan of action for the rollout of the UNDG guidelines. The resource kit on Indigenous peoples' issues developed by the Secretariat of the Forum, together with agencies, and a training module on Indigenous peoples' issues have become invaluable tools in this process. Several agencies shared information on their experiences and plans regarding training on Indigenous peoples' rights and issues. It was agreed that all stakeholders have to be involved in such training processes. With respect to consultation and participation mechanisms, several agencies provided examples of processes they were involved with for engaging with Indigenous communities at regional and country levels. The support group explored the challenges of defining the limits of consultation as opposed to participation, the advantages and disadvantages of formalized mechanisms as opposed to more flexible arrangements, and the challenging issue of appropriate and legitimate representation of Indigenous communities. With respect to communication and advocacy, the support group noted the importance of improving communication on Indigenous peoples' issues among the various agencies, but also with governments, notably within the framework of joint UN-UNDAF processes. All agencies confirmed the importance of country ownership, that is to say, government involvement at all stages of UN policy and programming, but also underlined the need for ownership of development programs by Indigenous communities and thus their equally active involvement. In terms of recommendations, the support group reaffirmed its continuing commitment to further implement the general plan of action for the rollout and implementation of the UNDG guidelines on Indigenous peoples' issues. It agreed to reinforce capacity-building efforts for all partners at the country level, while also taking steps to ensure better communication among members of the group. To these ends, the proposer was welcome to elaborate a project proposal on working together on Indigenous peoples' rights, a One UN project. This proposal would be implemented within the one UN framework by the members of the support group. It was furthermore agreed that the interagency support group could explore the possibility of establishing interagency support groups at the regional level, starting in Latin America, for example, in order to enhance coordination and communication among UN agencies in their promotion of indigenous peoples' issues at the regional level. Just a few comments on the new method of work very briefly for this session of the permanent forum. The support group discussed the new procedure that will be put into place at this session of the permanent forum with examination in depth of the work of a select number of UN agencies. As you know, the work of six agencies will be examined during this current session in particular depth. At the same time, all of the agencies also wish to have the opportunity to continue to provide short statements to the sessions of the forum when there is a need for such information to be transmitted. The support group looks forward to working with the forum in further developing this mechanism of in-depth examination so that it may evolve into a productive undertaking with concrete benefits for indigenous peoples. A few specific recommendations with respect to the second international decade, the world's indigenous peoples. The support group made a number of suggestions for consideration by the secretary of the permanent forum with respect to continuing the annual reporting mechanism as part of the midterm review process, to use the adoption of the 2007 declaration as an opportunity for a broad mobilization to rejuvenate the decade, to take stock of institutional progress within UN agencies and programs through the in-depth analysis of the six UN agencies, as well as a short contribution to be received from other agencies. And also to examine institutional change at the country level through, for example, analyses for specific countries comparing the situation of indigenous peoples and relevant policies at the beginning of the first decade and in the middle of this second decade. Finally, UNEP and UN Habitat have proposed to jointly host the annual meeting of the support group in Nairobi in 2009. We look forward to that opportunity. And I should mention that more detailed report is available of all of the results of the interagency support group meeting. Thank you very much.
I would like to thank the distinguished representative from UNESCO for his remarks, and to also thank him for the leadership shown by UNESCO when they served as the chairperson of the interagency support group, and also to encourage all of our indigenous delegates to read the comprehensive support submitted by UNESCO for this eighth session. I would like to recognize my colleague, Mr. Bartolome Clavero. He has his flag up. Mr. Clavero, you have the floor, sir.
Muchas gracias, señora vicepresidenta.
Thank you very much, Madam Vice Chair. Thank you, Tanya. I'd like to bring up something on the specific point of the agenda, in other words, on extractive industries. With regard to the remarks made by the representative of Brazil, who brought up several points, but I'd like to return to the issue of extractive industries. He referred to certain recent developments in Brazil with regard to indigenous rights, which he presented as being positive, but I do have some concerns on that front that I would like to bring up. Essentially, I would like to focus on a case which the representative of Brazil mentioned, the case of Raposa Serra Gasol, which led to the demarcation of a large area of territory for the indigenous communities of the area, returning to them the area which had been occupied by non-indigenous peoples. But that same decision of the Supreme Court of Justice of Brazil has some aspects which raise concern, and I want to ask about those. It does not recognize the property of the indigenous peoples. It recognizes a right to use of surface resources by indigenous peoples. Therefore, if the indigenous peoples of Brazil or of Peru have a voice and can decide on access and exploitation of resources under the surface by extractive industries, I cannot really tell whether this is clear. They have the right to use. This is not property. And this right is not acknowledged over natural resources which are not present on the surface, for example, is the case of water. It also says that the communities can defend themselves and therefore decide for themselves. There remains a series of problems. I understand this because the Constitution so establishes that indigenous communities in Brazil have to have assistance from the public prosecutor in order to submit a case to the courts. What this means is that it's not communities that decide whether to file a case, but the state. And this can affect cases as important as the one I've just alluded to. And in other cases, there have been conflicts between the state, between Brazil and the state of Roraima, or Brazil and indigenous communities of Brazil. To make this clear, it appears to me that the current status of the rights acknowledged for indigenous peoples of Brazil is at loggerheads with the current jurisprudence of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, which categorically states that the indigenous rights of peoples is the right to hold property. This right to ownership has not yet been acknowledged in Brazil. And this also goes against ILO Convention 169, because there is no clear statement of the right to consultation with regard to resources which are of interest to extractive industries. Mention has also been made that Brazil is registering native peoples in the civil registry, but this is not part of the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Consultation is mentioned in the declaration, and as well as consultation of the representatives freely elected by these people themselves, not through a census conducted by the state. And the understanding is that it's all indigenous peoples and not just the representatives who have to be consulted. And also very briefly, just to create some background, all these concerns arise because of activities such as those of Peru. Peru dismantled all of the legal standards protecting indigenous peoples and the rights to consultation. The Committee of Experts on the Application of Conventions and Recommendations of the ILO called on Peru to justify this policy against the right to consultation. The Congress of Peru spoke against the policy of the government of Peru, which dismantled all the mechanisms protecting the rights of indigenous peoples. And this was done in order to offer concessions to extractive industries who entered indigenous territories, basically in the Amazon region of Peru, without the least guarantee of the rights of indigenous peoples, or even the procedures of consultations being observed. I'm recalling this because There is no doubt that the government of Brazil is conducting a very respectful policy with regard to neighboring states, not just Peru, but also Bolivia. In political terms, Brazil, as a state and as a member of UNASUR, has a very active position when it comes to support of the constitutional government of Bolivia and its respect for the indigenous people's rights. But the perception in the entire indigenous Amazon region of Peru and Bolivia is that Brazil is defending major landholdings in Brazil against indigenous peoples, and that Brazil is supporting the Peruvian policy of denying and eliminating all the mechanisms to defend the rights of indigenous peoples. The case of Peru is a very grave instance because Peru has militarized the entire Amazon region, suspended all the rights of indigenous peoples, and is subjecting indigenous areas to military occupation. Faced with a deafening silence of neighbors like Brazil, which did not remain silent when the Department of Santa Cruz in neighboring Bolivia was also occupied. I'm not questioning the facts that the representative of Brazil has just brought up. I believe that they are reliable, but there are some dark areas in the region which give rise to serious concern. Thank you very much.
I would like to thank my distinguished colleague, Mr. Clavera, for his remarks. And I would like to give the floor to the distinguished colleague, or the distinguished representative from Brazil. Sir, you have the floor.
Germany.
Oh.
Germany and then Brazil will answer.
This.
Germany.
Pardon me. I've been corrected by the Secretariat. And I would like to acknowledge His Excellency from Germany, the Ambassador Dr. Martinet. Mr. Ambassador, you have the floor.
Madam Chairperson, Excellencies, representatives of indigenous populations, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for giving me the floor. Respect of and support for the rights of indigenous peoples has been and remains a major objective of German economic and development cooperation. Germany voted in support of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and takes their interests into account in the framework of our bilateral political talks with countries with indigenous population. German development cooperation and human rights projects aim at strengthening the rights and improving the living conditions of indigenous people, as well as reinforcing the networks of indigenous organizations at national and cross-border level. I am particularly pleased to announce that Germany will again contribute this year to the Indigenous Trust Funds with an amount of $50,000. I think this demonstrates our engagement in promoting the participation of the indigenous population representatives to important events like the Permanent Indigenous Forum, as well as our support for the objectives of the second international decade of the world's indigenous peoples. Madam Chairperson, in 2006, the German government adopted a strategy paper entitled Development Cooperation with Indigenous Peoples in Latin America and Caribbean. The explicit aim of the German Development Cooperation is to assist indigenous peoples in articulating, exercising, and asserting their right to self-determined development. In implementation of this strategy, Germany adopts a two-pronged approach. First, this approach actively strengthens indigenous organizations in the Amazon basins, the Andean highlands, and Guatemala. Secondly, it also supports indigenous peoples and their organizations through a multisectoral approach. Respect for the rights and needs of indigenous peoples is mainstreamed in all German development cooperation activities in Latin America. For its implementation, Germany has invested €20 million since 2006. Madam Chairperson, in answer to the recommendations by the 7th session of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, I would like to highlight shortly three issues in particular: climate change, the preservation of indigenous languages, and finally, indigenous women's rights. First, let me start with climate change. The conservation and sustainable use of land and natural resources is one of the thematic priorities of Germany's strategy for cooperation with the indigenous peoples in Latin America. We acknowledge that traditional territories and their resources are vital for all indigenous peoples, and we also know that climate change already threatens their survival in many areas. For this reason, Germany strongly supported the participation of indigenous organizations from Latin America in the international negotiations in 2008 on biodiversity protected areas and the Framework Convention on Climate Change. This year, too, Germany is helping indigenous organizations from Latin America to prepare for and take part in the forthcoming negotiations on the Framework Convention on Climate Change. Germany programs for demarcating Indian territories in the Brazilian Amazon region and the promotion of small pilot projects in the Indian territories in Brazil are successful examples on conserving traditional environments. These programs are part of a large multilateral pilot program to preserve the Brazilian rainforest, which is coordinated by the Brazilian Ministry of the Environment and the World Bank. The aim of demarcation is to support the National Indian Foundation in securing and protecting Indian territories with the involvement of the population concerned. In the last year, 115 territories have been legally demarcated with German aid, with a total area larger than the whole of Germany. Second, on the revival of indigenous languages, let me mention the German support of the Development Fund for Indigenous Peoples in Latin America and the Caribbean in establishing the network of the Indigenous Intercultural Universities. The purpose of this initiative is to train highly qualified personnel for indigenous organizations and Latin American governments on indigenous and intercultural issues. Since 2005, 18 universities and indigenous organizations from 10 countries have joined the network, and 204 students have so far completed the postgraduate courses. Third, my final point is on indigenous women's rights. In its National Gender Action Plan, Germany stipulates gender equality and women's empowerment as an inherent and explicit goal and a general principle of project and program design in German development policy. This also applies to the cooperation with indigenous peoples in Latin America. In the last 4 years, German development cooperation has aligned its programs more closely with the rights and needs of indigenous people, particularly in Latin America. Besides relevant adjustments to program design, German development cooperation personnel are also trained in intercultural topics, including the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Therefore, Germany contributes to implementing the declaration as per Article 42. Madam Chairperson, I conclude by reiterating Germany's support to indigenous peoples and the successful implementation of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Thank you very much for the floor.
I would like to thank very much the ambassador, the distinguished ambassador from Germany, for his kind patience and for his very generous contribution to the Trust Fund, for his country's generous support of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and for his kind explanation of his country's three-prong approach on climate change, the gender equality in indigenous women, and of course the support of our languages, which we take very, very seriously, and his mention of Article 42. Thank you very much, Mr. Ambassador. We do appreciate your being with us today. And I would be remiss if I did not acknowledge the most important person sitting to your right, the Ambassador, Dr. Erica Irene Dias, who served as chairperson of the Indigenous, and we should acknowledge her and give her our warm greetings and love, Dr. Erica Irene Dias. If you would stand, Madam Dias. As you all know, she served for many years, over 20 years, as chairperson of the Working Group on Indigenous Populations, and we are honored to have her here in our presence. Thank you, Madam Dias, for being here. I would like to next call on the distinguished representative from Brazil, who will respond to my distinguished colleague, Mr. Clavera's statement. Sir, you have the floor.
Merci.
Thank you very much. I shall be brief. I simply wanted to restate the importance for Brazil, and I believe for all indigenous peoples of Brazil, of the final demarcation of the indigenous lands of Serrapsol, which is very important, even with the conditions established by the Supreme Court. In Brazil, we respect the decisions of the Supreme Court as representatives of the executive branch. We will continue to conduct the demarcation of indigenous territories in accordance with the federal constitution. We are opening to discuss with you, sir, about the very important issues you've raised on Brazilian policy. We also are very concerned by the issues affecting indigenous peoples of the Amazon, and we've even made efforts to cooperate with Peru, for example, because Brazil has a policy, a long-standing policy for the protection of isolated indigenous peoples, and we wish to cooperate with our neighbors when it comes to protecting indigenous populations. The issue of the demarcation of indigenous regions in Brazil, I'd also like to thank the government of Germany, whose representative has just spoken, because we have major cooperation with the government of Germany when it comes to the demarcation of indigenous territories in Brazil, especially in the Amazon region. It's 25% of the Amazon. This is a very large area, and it's very important not only for the protection of indigenous peoples, but also biodiversity in the Amazon. Thank you very much.
To thank the representative from Brazil. The next speaker on the list is from the African Caucus, Kanyenke Sinya. The African Caucus has the floor. I must ask for your cooperation in being very succinct and to please follow the time limit. The African Caucus has the floor. Could you raise your hand, please, and be acknowledged? The African Caucus? Madam, you have the floor. If you would raise your hand, please. And start speaking. Excellent. Thank you.
The, oh my God. the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues theme touches the soul of indigenous peoples' debate in Africa. Economic marginalization and social exclusion in all spheres of life account for the massive human rights abuses experienced by indigenous peoples in Africa on a daily basis. The human rights abuses range from the eviction of 11,000 communities in Tanzania and in around the Ngorongoro Crater, a world-renowned tourism destination, and consequent loss of over 400,000 livestock by the eviction leading to serious livelihood and quality of life consequences. In Gabon and other Congo basin countries, hunter-gatherers have limited access to education, health facilities, means of earning livelihoods, and in an increasingly changing environment, common problems for many indigenous groups throughout Africa. Land and resources are recurring themes in the marginalization of African indigenous peoples. In the DRC, Batwa Pygmy people are denied the right to live in the forest where they have hunted and gathered, disconnecting them from their basic needs. In some areas, resource extraction ignores the effects it has on indigenous groups, such as in Niger, where the exploitation of uranium has resulted in forced displacement of indigenous peoples and contamination of the natural environment on which they depend. This is resulting in conflicts as young Tuaregs take up arms to demand the involvement of their people in the political administration of their region. Indigenous groups in Gabon have been forcibly sedentarized only to be moved to villages where they lack access to jobs, healthcare, and the tools to successfully embark on small-scale agriculture. To halt such violations of human rights and ensuring conflicts that will end, we urge that African national governments adopt domestic laws that are in the spirit of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. We urge the Permanent Forum to study the effects of conflicts on the economic and social rights of the indigenous peoples of Africa, especially women and youth, and push for their protection given the vulnerability in times of armed conflict by formulating specific policies for aiding indigenous peoples in achieving the development of their communities and the survival of their way of life. This needs to change in order to address the specific problems faced by our communities. We urge climate change is also a reality that is endangering the natural environment on which many indigenous peoples depend for their livelihoods. Adaptation strategies are not being prioritized at the UNFCCC discussion, but there is a clamor for mitigation-oriented activities with 14 African countries already involved in the World Bank Forest Carbon Partnership. There is no recognition of indigenous peoples, their rights or livelihood in developing national RED strategies. We urge the Permanent Forum to monitor the rights of indigenous peoples in the development of national RED strategies and to urge UN agencies to prioritize adaptation over mitigation. In this second international decade of the world's indigenous people, we urge UN agencies to stop abetting African governments in promoting purely agriculture policies that marginalize pastoralists and hunter-gatherer livelihoods. Finally, we take this opportunity to welcome the efforts of the Republic of Congo to formulate an indigenous people's law. It is a positive step for indigenous peoples in Africa, and we urge the Permanent Forum to put more pressure on the African governments to recognize the presence and address the specific issues of indigenous peoples in their territories as per the African Commission on Human and People's Rights decision in 2003. And though we appreciate the establishment of the human rights expert mechanism, we are yet to feel its presence in Africa, and the forum should ensure that it is funded enough to be able to address human rights issues facing indigenous peoples in Africa. I thank you.
I would like to thank the representative from the African Caucus, our friend and sister Mary, for doing such an excellent job and staying within the time limit. And I know she was under a great deal of pressure, but you did a wonderful job. Thank you, Mary, very much. I am going to go to the distinguished representative from the government of Chile, Mr. Alvaro Marafin, as the next speaker on the list. Mr. Marafin, if you would take the floor. Sir, you have the floor. Thank you so much.
Señora Presidenta.
Madam Chair, distinguished members of the forum, let me begin by adding my congratulations already expressed on the election of the new president or chairwoman. We come to the forum aware of what we have achieved and the challenges and commitment to progress even further, to continue building a multicultural country. Since 1990, we have been moving along the path of reconstruction of the democratic system based on respect for fundamental freedoms and human rights, civil, political, economic, social, and cultural, in order to reach the necessary agreements with all members of society with no exclusion. This democratic construction of Chilean society is not based on the proclamation of rights in the abstract sense, but rather on the creation of economic and social conditions so all rights can be effectively exercised. Since 1993, when the indigenous law was passed, till today, Chile has set a new scene where conditions and challenges require a new focus. This new focus is given by the ratification of ILO Convention 169. From there onwards, it is not only the government which is responsible for building an inclusive society and recognizing the equality of the rights of all members, but it is a society which assumes its co-responsibility with government. We are aware we must make we must exert every possible effort to ensure full implementation of ILO Convention 169. On April 1st of last year, President Michelle Bachelet announced the plan of action of the public policy on indigenous peoples of Chile. This policy is entitled Social Pact for Multiculturality, Recognizing, and it lists the commitments the government is making with the indigenous peoples of the country. These commitments are gathered from the various texts which express the desires and demands of indigenous peoples and which fall into the three major areas of the political system, rights and institutionality, integrated development of peoples, multiculturality and diversity. In the area of the political system, rights and institutionality, a commitment was made to approve Convention 169 of the ILO and its implementation through the legal and institutional necessary mechanisms. This came to a high point with the passage of the decree of passage published in the Official Gazette of October 14, 2008. It thus became an integral part of Chilean law. And this convention will enter into force next September 15. Madam Chair, since the publication of Convention 169, the government of Chile has been taking the necessary measures to adapt national legislation to this international instrument. Measures such as the establishment in June 2008 of the Ministerial Council for Indigenous Affairs, made up of 15 ministers, and focused on the coordination, monitoring, and adoption of all necessary administrative measures to adapt the government's action to the provisions of the convention. Presidential Directive of June 2008 established five actions: the creation of a unit of Indigenous Affairs in each ministry, establishment of actions and initiatives in the area of jurisdiction of each ministry, which will recognize, establish policies to recognize, promote, and encourage cultural diversity. The policies, plans, and programs of each ministry were studied and adopted to include Indigenous relevance. Budgets allocated to the design or execution of such plans were identified, and a mechanism for information and consultation of Indigenous peoples was established. In the same directive, the regional roundtables were set up as a joint work mechanism with the Indigenous communities. A plan for consultation of Indigenous peoples on two bills, the first on Indigenous participation in Parliament and the second on the creation of a National Council of Indigenous Peoples, was established. There is also a study of the Code of Ethical Conduct currently being reviewed, which will regulate processes of public and private investment in Indigenous areas and areas for Indigenous development. The Diego Portales University of Chile has been charged with studying the different legal bodies to determine the modifications needed for our legislation to be in accordance with ILO Convention 169. Each of these proposed amendments will be subject to consultation processes. In this way, we are following the three principles of Convention 169: consultation, participation, and cooperation. Madam Chair, the Government of Chile has shown its will to deepen and ensure compliance with the agreements between the state and Indigenous peoples in the past in search of their economic, social, and cultural development from a holistic perspective with respect for diversity and identity. For this purpose, a commitment to refine the establishment of Indigenous development has been established, creating it in all territories which call for it, with full participation of communities, defining a development plan for each area and providing the necessary resources for its operation. There will also be more detailed plans and programs based on which the government intends to immediately encourage productive development and innovation between Indigenous peoples, respecting their political, social, economic, and social specificities. For this purpose, we are executing a program of rural connectivity, the restructuring of the Origins Program, a model of planning and resources which will strengthen communities on an economic, social, and cultural basis, thanks to an IDB credit, an infrastructure program for housing, drinking water, and rural electrification, and an innovation program developed by regional development agencies. Madam Chair, one of the most sensitive areas for families and Indigenous communities in Chile is that of land tenure. Since the Indigenous laws adopted in October 1993, the State of Chile has established a mechanism to make progress in responding to demands for land and water by these communities. In March of this year, this procedure has made it possible to hand over a total surface of 588,000 hectares of land to Indigenous communities. We recognize that these processes police have provided the measures and necessary resources for compliance. So communities which had not had been given land in 2001-2007 have increased to 43 more communities. Madam Chair, on September 13 of 2007, the government of Chile voted in favor of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Although much progress remains to be made, as a government, we are certain that with the political determination, civic maturity, and spirit of cooperation and dialogue of all levels of society, we will move ever more surely towards full recognition of the rights of Indigenous peoples and towards a multicultural society. Thank you very much.
I would like to thank the observer government of of the government of Chile. I would like to call now on the representative of Mr. John Rogge, the special representative of the Secretary General on the issue of human rights and transnational corporations and other business enterprises, Ms. Rachel Davis. And after her, I will call on Patricia Laurie. So, Ms. Davis, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Distinguished members of the Permanent Forum, representatives of Indigenous peoples, distinguished elders. The special representative has asked me to convey his sincere regrets that he is not able to be here in person, as he is currently attending a mandate consultation in Buenos Aires, Argentina. In 2005, the then Commission on Human Rights requested the Secretary General to appoint a special representative on the issue of business and human rights. John Rogge, a professor at Harvard Kennedy School and former UN Assistant Secretary General, was appointed to the post. In June 2008, he proposed a conceptual and policy framework to advance the business and human rights agenda. The framework rests on three pillars. First, the state duty to protect against human rights abuses by third parties, including business, through appropriate policies, regulation, and adjudication. Second, the corporate responsibility to respect human rights, which means to act with due diligence to avoid infringing on the rights of others. And third, greater access for victims to effective remedy, both judicial and non-judicial. The Council unanimously welcomed the Protect, Respect and Remedy framework, the first time that it or its predecessor, the Commission, had endorsed a substantive policy position on this issue. The framework was also supported by leading international human rights organizations and by the major international business associations. The Council extended the Special Representative's mandate for another 3 years, tasking him with operationalizing the framework to provide concrete guidance to states, businesses, and other social actors. The first pillar of the framework, the state duty to protect, is grounded in international human rights law. Most states have adopted core human rights standards, but there is still considerable legal and policy incoherence at the domestic and international levels. The Special Representative has urged governments to drive the business and human rights agenda into those areas that most directly shape business practices, including corporate law, export credit and insurance, and investment and trade agreements. He has also called for enhanced cooperation between so-called home states, where companies are headquartered, and host states, where companies operate, to better protect rights, including in challenging environments like conflict-affected areas. The second pillar of the framework, the corporate responsibility to respect rights, is based on the near-universal recognition that companies should not infringe on the rights of others. This responsibility is the baseline norm for all companies in all situations, and it applies to the entire spectrum of internationally recognized rights. Companies should put in place a process of ongoing human rights due diligence to become aware of, prevent, and mitigate adverse human rights impacts. This has four core elements: having a human rights policy, assessing the human rights impacts of company activities, integrating those values and findings into corporate cultures and management systems, and tracking and reporting on performance. Without access to effective remedy, however, the framework's third pillar, the rights of affected individuals and communities would be rendered weak or even meaningless. For states, this means enforcing and encouraging corporate compliance with relevant laws and standards. For companies, this means putting in place operational level grievance mechanisms to provide early warning and help resolve problems before they escalate. Significant barriers to accessing effective judicial and non-judicial remedies persist, and the Special Representative is identifying those that are particularly salient for victims of corporate-related human rights abuses, as well as strategies to reduce them. In operationalizing this framework, the Special Representative considers it important to better understand the particular position and experiences of Indigenous peoples. States have clear duties to protect their rights under regional and international human rights treaties, and the Special Representative has noted the guidance provided by the relevant human rights bodies on how these duties may operate in the context of corporate-related abuse. He has also referenced other key international instruments mentioned here today, including ILO Convention 169 and the recent UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which many of you worked so hard to see come to pass. In relation to the corporate responsibility to respect, he has consistently said that in projects affecting Indigenous peoples, companies should consider these additional international standards that are specific to those communities. In 2007, he held a consultation in Colombia focused on how companies can maintain their social license to operate among local communities, particularly Indigenous peoples. He notes the important ongoing work of the forum on these issues, as well as that of related UN initiatives. Throughout his mandate, the Special Representative has sought to adopt an evidence-based consultative approach. He has been pleased to receive and continues to welcome submissions on his work from civil society, including groups focused on Indigenous peoples' rights, and he has benefited from the constructive involvement of a wide range of participants in his various multi-stakeholder consultations. Several representatives of Indigenous communities from South America are attending the current mandate consultation in Buenos Aires. The international community is still in the early phases of adapting the human rights regime to provide more effective protection to individuals and communities against corporate-related harm. The framework proposed by the Special Representative and endorsed by the Human Rights Council provides a common platform for advancing the business and human rights agenda. States, companies, and civil society, including, of course, Indigenous peoples, all have an important role to play in making this happen. And the Special Representative welcomes your input as he works to turn the framework into guiding principles. Thank you, and best wishes for a successful meeting.
Thank you very much. I would like to thank the representative of the Special Representative of the Secretary General on Business and Human Rights. This is the first time that we are able to get them to take part in our forum, and I think her recommendations are going to be very important for us. So please make your statement available to the Secretariat so we can also take a look at this when we make our reports. I would like to call now I would like to seek the indulgence of the Canadian delegation, but I would like to call first and Patrice Laurie, the ambassador of Ecuador, has a meeting with the General Assembly President, so she is requesting to speak now. So I call on Her Excellency Ms. Maria Fernanda Espinosa, the representative of the mission of Ecuador, the permanent representative of the mission of Ecuador to the UN. You have the floor, Madam.
Muchas gracias, señora presidenta.
Thank you very much, Madam Co-Chairperson. And I do apologize for having modified the list of speakers. I would like to congratulate you on being elected to chair the 8th session of the permanent forum. You can count on full support of my delegation in order to move us forward the most effectively possible. We welcome the fact that we could participate at the governmental level and at the level of National Indigenous Association in the long process of coming up with the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, which we finally adopted by the General Assembly in September 2007, which is a memorable date for all of the Indigenous people throughout the world. The important role played by my country, Ecuador, comes from the fight of our Indigenous peoples and the commitment of my government to recognize their rights through its policies, through institutions, and the management of development. Madam Chairperson, Chairperson, the new Constitution of Ecuador adopted in September 2008 is a new step forward because it has enabled us to create a fair, democratic, multinational, multicultural society. Despite the fact that we do have many challenges that we need to rise to, we already can share with you certain strides that I would like to sum up. We constitutionally recognize ourselves as a plurinational state. And this means that we recognize the language, the culture, the way of life, the identity, the collective rights of the indigenous peoples, of Afro-Ecuadorian peoples and Montubias, in line with international declarations and human rights. And this in turn means that including the rights of peoples and nationalities of indigenous peoples in the Constitution is based on the principles underlying international instruments, such as the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of the Indigenous People and Convention 169 of the ILO. Madam Chairperson, Ecuador has the system at the highest level of the state because we're trying to make sure that Afro-Ecuadorian and Mantubia's populations, our indigenous people, participate in the development, assessment, monitoring, and accountability of the various rights provided to them in our new constitution, such as, for example, creating indigenous territorial circumscriptions, special entities for the recognition of ancestral way of lives, the recognition of 21 collective rights in our main charter. My country includes its goals of similar nature in our national development plan, which provides for the strengthening of their identity and interculturality. This link between the National Development Plan and the guarantee of indigenous people's rights aims at creating for greater societal cohesion and territorial cohesion of these people, protect their identity, the intercultural nature of our country in a measurable way. I would like to underscore the fact that Ecuador welcomes the recommendations of the special representative on the issue of human rights in the wake of its mission in my country in 2006. In the wake of that, we at the national level undertook a number of measures to implement them. As regards the implementation of the indigenous rights who are isolated voluntarily, thanks to the Yasumi Etete, we decided not to exploit the depositor of 920 million barrels of oil in the national park, which is their territory. This initiative enabled the government to also respect the protection measure which came out of the Inter-American Human Rights Commission and to show our level of commitment. In addition to that, we also developed the national policy on the people who are in voluntary isolation, which is necessary for us to move forward. Furthermore, we have a national plan for such people. We invest $500,000 in 2008 and more in 2009.
It's important to know that the efforts to ensure the well-being of indigenous peoples must be accompanied by specific actions to combat poverty and measures for social inclusion. We know that poverty in many cases more acutely affects indigenous peoples. This is why the state of Ecuador in 2007-2008 has achieved social spending for the first time in our history to be higher than payment of external debt, taking measures such as channeling surplus of petroleum prices to productive credits, increase in social investment, particularly for indigenous peoples, doubling the human development bonus, increasing the housing bonus, and increasing investment in health and education. The government of Ecuador is also actively working with several United Nations agencies especially the Interagency Group on Interculturality, led by UNFPA. The Ministry Coordinating Natural Heritage and Culture, and the National Secretariat for State Planning. To implement the Program for Development and Cultural Diversity to Reduce Poverty and Increase Social Inclusion. This program supports strategies to attain MDGs, especially MDGs 1, 2, 3, 5, and 7. With the support of the United Nations in Ecuador, we have initiated the design of the national plan to eliminate racism and ethnic exclusion. The government is also developing strategies to incorporate the intercultural focus in policies, plans, programs, and institutional projects, with actions to close the gaps and inequity. In order to ensure a better education, we are following the objectives of the National Development Plan and constitutional guarantees. In order to eradicate illiteracy, with special interest in indigenous peoples and nationalities, the Dolores Cacuango Program for Indigenous Languages has been designed. Ecuador now has 27,000 community educators who are working mainly in the rural areas and who have prepared material for literacy and post-literacy, covering 24 provinces and all indigenous nationalities. By August 10 this year, we will be able to declare our country as free of illiteracy, which is part of the bicentenary celebration of our independence. We know that a lot remains to be done, but we know that important steps have been taken to turn Ecuador into a society which respects the dignity of peoples and persons. Ecuador is and will continue to be committed to the fight of indigenous peoples for the full recognition of their collective rights. The indigenous peoples of the world can count on my country and my government to effectively enforce the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and other international instruments and mechanisms promoting their well-being in a full, broad, and integrated way. And I call on all countries to adopt these instruments and implement them. We trust that this will happen before the end of the second international decade of Indigenous Peoples of the World. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank
you very much. I would like to now call on Patricia Laurie from the National Native Title Council Aboriginal Legal Rights Movement and other Indigenous organizations in Australia. Patricia Laurie, you have the floor. Yes, press the button, please.
No. Thank you, Madam Chair. I wish to make a couple of acknowledgements. First and foremost, the rapporteur of the UN Permanent Forum, Professor Mick Dodson. Also wish to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land we speak on, and traditional owners within the state of within America. The Indigenous Australian delegation acknowledges the previous work of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous issues concerning economic and social development, and supports a conclusion recognising UN agencies and intergovernmental bodies' responses to the recommendations of the forum in this regard. Where are we? Governments have not followed on from the leadership provided by these UN agencies. In particular, we consider that the Australian government's approach is not consistent with the principles outlined by the forum in supporting social and economic development for Indigenous people. For example, past and current employment and enterprise development strategies failed to adequately engage Indigenous Australians to provide meaningful and lasting economic and social benefits for Indigenous Australians. Because those strategies are largely based around mainstream ideologies, for Australians, Generally, high levels of employment ensure that people are able to enjoy high standard of living. The assumption that mainstream employment strategies are transferable to the Indigenous context is not only misleading, but it helps to compound the deliberation of Indigenous people and our rights to access parity with the rest of Australians. Other areas of social economic development, such as investment in and control of infrastructure and enterprise development, including ecotourism and the utilisation and development of natural resources, are not readily supported by governments. Government policy must recognise and incorporate the primary role that Indigenous people have to play as a core part of general business activities and overall national wealth creation, for example, through caring for country. In spite of both extensive and considered advice from the Permanent Forum and other UN agencies, governments in Australia continue to disregard people-driven approaches to addressing Indigenous disadvantages. While the ongoing push for practical outcomes, as is the approach of the Australian government, is seen as a means of resolving Indigenous disadvantage, too often such policy approaches disrupts and undermines the exercise and enjoyment of human rights by Indigenous Australians. International frameworks such as the Millennium Development Goals are not supported by governments in the Australian context. However, they offer guidance based on the principle of respecting human rights. Government policy and programs need to address, among other things, social justice and reconciliation, community development and empowerment, and culturally appropriate therapies. Many nation states, including Australia, have a history of assimilation policies and the control by government of all aspects of lives of Indigenous people, for example, through the forced removal of Indigenous children from our families. While governments have acknowledged the harm caused historically by such policies, they appear to not have learnt from those experiences. Whilst we recognise the safety and the protection of our children must be the main priority, government interventions in this regard must be in accordance with human rights principles. While children are not being forcibly removed as they were previously, contemporary government policies retains the intention of assimilating Indigenous peoples. We therefore recommend, number one, that the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues encouraged the Interagency Support Group on Indigenous Issues to consider developing an international research agenda that reviews the economic, social and health impacts of past and current assimilation strategies and policies approaches. Two, that the United Permanent Forum of Indigenous Issues encourages states to adopt employment policies and economic and social development strategies are consistent with A, the articles of relevant ILO conventions, B, the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People, C, the readings and advice of the Special Representative of the Secretary General on the issue of human rights and transnational corporations other business enterprise. That the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues encouraged states to recognise the need for health investment in order for Indigenous peoples to contribute to the economic and social development of their own communities and more broadly to national economies. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Patricia Lowry from various Indigenous organisations. I would like now to call on the Observer Government of Canada, Mr. Fred Caron, Assistant Deputy Minister, Indian and Northern Affairs, Canada. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Canada wishes to commend the Permanent Forum for its decision to modify its working methods by focusing in alternate years on implementation of previous recommendations. It's hoped that this review and analysis of the status of the large body of existing recommendations will provide improved coherence and guidance for all affected parties. Madam Chair and members of the Forum, Canada is committed to an integrated, strategic, and targeted approach to address the unacceptable socioeconomic gaps that exist in Canada for Indigenous peoples. Our approach is founded upon the protection and promotion of Aboriginal and treaty rights in an atmosphere of reconciliation and renewed relationship. The approach has stressed action on the ground and has focused on the following five priorities: economic development, education, empowering First Nations citizens and protecting the vulnerable, resolution of land claims, and reconciliation, governance, and self-government. It is our sincere hope and expectation that this integrated and comprehensive approach will be an effective instrument in achieving our overarching goal of improving the quality of life for Aboriginal people.
Madam Chairperson, the economic recession has ramifications on everyone in every country, and the disadvantaged and vulnerable, including the Indigenous people in this group, may be most severely hit by this. It is therefore important, according to us, that measures undertaken to react to the present economic situation take this into account. On the 27th January 2009, the government presented the Canada Economic Plan of Action, which was a reaction to the economic decline globally. The Prime Minister and the heads of provincial territorial governments met together with the Indigenous people's leaders on the 15th of January 2009, prior to the launching of this plan, and they agreed to provide assistance to the Indigenous people, labor in the area of training, also making sure that infrastructure projects have positive spillover for the Indigenous people, especially when it comes to employment, development of competencies, and business opportunities.
It is designed to stimulate the Canadian economy, to protect Canadians during the global recession, and to invest in long-term growth. The Aboriginal-specific initiatives outlined in the Economic Action Plan share a common objective, that is, ensuring Aboriginal people have the opportunity to participate fully in Canada's economy and society with the government's five previously identified priorities. More precisely, Canada's Economic Action Plan announced $1.4 billion Canadian in investments over 2 years related to Aboriginal-specific programming in areas such as housing, educational facilities, skills and training, health, water and wastewater system, and child and family services.
Madam Chairperson, in line with the Canada's Economic Action Plan, the government of my country made Indigenous economic development a priority and committed itself to create a new federal framework in this area. Therefore, the government, in partnership with the First Nations, the Inuits and the Métis, works towards the development of a new strategy for economic development, which will be based on partnership
in helping to create the conditions for responsible and sustainable development affecting Indigenous peoples in other countries. In March 2009, the Government of Canada announced its Corporate Social Responsibility Strategy for the Canadian extractive sector operating abroad. Madam Chair, Canada has also made significant progress in helping ensure that First Nations have access to safe drinking water. Since 2006, when the government launched the Plan of Action for Drinking Water in First Nations Communities, the number of First Nations communities with high-risk water systems has been reduced by two-thirds. Out of the 21 priority communities identified in 2006, only four remain today, and action plans are in place for each. Madame la Présidente.
Madam Chairperson, social and economic development is something that has to begin with education. Improving academic results of Indigenous students is a responsibility which is shared, and governments, communities, families, and students themselves play a key role. In December 2008, the government launched two new programs which create permanent basis to improve in the long term the teaching for the First Nations members, the programs of academic success for students from First Nations and the education partnership programs. The federal government of my country cooperates also with provinces who are interested in this and the First Nations, and we create tripartite dialogue on health issues. These meetings aim at improving the state of health of the indigenous populations in Canada by integrating health services aimed at First Nations within the system of health care in provinces through the funding coming from the federal government and giving greater decision-making powers to First Nations on the topics which are affect them in the area of health care.
Forum Secretariat Analysis report states that, quote, the Government of Canada has been the main supporter for keeping urban Indigenous issues at the forefront. Canada has appreciated and benefited from working with the Permanent Forum, UN Habitat, and other UN agencies, as well as member states and Indigenous peoples' representatives, in advancing cooperation at the international level on urban Indigenous issues. There remain much to be done, and Canada remains committed to advancing this important work. Finally, Madam Chair, Canada's efforts to address the socioeconomic needs of Aboriginal Canadians were reinforced in June 2008 when the Prime Minister of Canada issued an apology to the survivors of residential schools. The apology reinforces numerous other government initiatives designed to address the tragic legacy of Indian residential schools. We hope to have an opportunity to say more about this issue later in the session. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would note that a longer version of this statement is available. Thank you again.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Mr. Fred Caron of the Observer Government of Canada. I would like now to call on Her Excellency Ms. Claudia Bloom, the Permanent Representative of Colombia, and after her, I will call on Florina Lopez from the Global Indigenous Women's Caucus and the International Labour Organization. Her Excellency, Ms. Claudia Bloom, you have the floor.
Muchas gracias, señora presidenta.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Allow me to greet the members of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues and to express our readiness to cooperate and to contribute to the development of the 8th session of this important body. Colombia is proud of its ethnic, linguistic, and cultural diversity. The process of recognition, promotion, and enhancement of the rights of the 84 indigenous groups living in Colombia, which represent 3.3% of the country's population, has been strengthened. Legislation, jurisprudence, and policies implemented by various public authorities, as well as the various mechanisms for dialogue and consultation with the participation of these communities, have supported this advancement. In relation to economic and social development, I would like to highlight that there is an institutional framework working on policies for ethnic groups and for their protection. In the executive branch, the direction of Indigenous Issues, Minorities, and Rom of the Ministry of the Interior implement actions aimed at realizing and guaranteeing social, economic, political, and cultural rights of Indigenous peoples to enhance their living conditions and to strengthen their organizational and development processes in accordance with their social-cultural diversity. Among the various strategies, we continue to advance in the recognition of land property titles for Indigenous communities. These titles are imprescriptible, inalienable, and not subject to embargo. They comprise 710 Indigenous reservations with an approximate area of 32 million hectares, nearly 29% of the national territory. The legislation also provides for the allocation of budget resources for these reservations and their share in royalties from the exploitation of non-renewable natural resources that might be located in these areas. Within its jurisdiction, the Ministry of Interior and Justice lead prior consultations with Indigenous peoples on projects to be implemented in their territories and administrative and legislative measures that may directly affect them. The existing national legal framework, including ILO Convention 169,
and the jurisprudence of the Constitutional Court has allowed these processes to be consolidated. 53 consultation processes were carried out in 2008 on activities to be developed in these territories. Several affirmative actions have contributed to the effective enjoyment of economic, social, and cultural rights of indigenous communities. To reduce poverty and improve living conditions, several indigenous communities were integrated in programs led by the Presidential Agency for Social Action. Among them are infrastructure development, food security initiatives, the Families in Action program, providing transfers or subsidies conditional on commitments to education and child nutrition, the Ranger Families program that offers social and technical support, and economic incentives for production alternatives and projects, contributing to sustainable forest management. And lastly, the program of assistance to internally displaced persons. The integrated plan to support indigenous communities living in under high risk or in extremely vulnerable conditions has also continued in 12 departments. In order to identify actions with concrete institutional commitments, including budget commitments. In the general social security system, the right to health is guaranteed to Indigenous people through insurance subsidized by the state. These communities can also operate their own health service promoters and providers. The Ministry of Education continues to promote the ethnic education policy to enhance and complement the educational system in Indigenous communities. These models are built on educational projects created by the ethnic community itself. Also, the Colombian Institute of Family Welfare provides nutritional supplements to indigenous children and programs that contribute to prevent dropping out and promote school attendance. The Ministry of Culture has implemented strategies such as indigenous radio stations, cultural broadcasting on public television, and projects to identify expressions of intangible heritage. Another achievement was the launching of the Cancuamo television channel, broadcasting from the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta to preserve customs of an ancestral indigenous community. In the field of information, the National Department of Statistics works to deliver quantitative data on living conditions of minority populations and to promote mainstreaming of the ethnic variable in the design of public policies. Madam Chair, to conclude, my delegation wishes to reiterate and share with the participants in this forum the decision by the government of Colombia this year to express its unilateral support to the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, to the spirit of the declaration and the principles that inspired its content, and our adherence to the concepts of equality, respect for diversity, and non-discrimination, which are the basis of this declaration. This decision was announced last April 21st in the context of the Durban Review Conference. Colombia expressed its appreciation for the historic importance of this declaration on that occasion and values the aspirations that inspire it. To this end, the government delivered a note to the Secretary General of the United Nations explaining this national decision. In this note, we reiterated that the references to affirmative and special rights of indigenous peoples, to the promotion of self-determination and the respect for pluralism and ethnic and cultural diversity, are supported by Colombia. In international forums and in international instruments and domestic legislation, we reaffirm our commitment to deepen the relationship and dialogue between state institutions and indigenous communities in accordance with our constitutional responsibility to consolidate the enjoyment of political, civil, economic, social and cultural rights for all Colombians. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Her Excellency Claudia Bloom of the Observer Government of Colombia. I now like to call on Florina Lopez, who will speak on behalf of the Global Indigenous Women's Caucus. You have the floor, madam.
Is Florina Lopez in the room?
Yes.
Yes, you have the floor.
Señora Presidenta.
Madam Chair, members of the United Nations Permanent Forum, distinguished representatives of indigenous peoples, brothers and sisters here today, indigenous women are the human embodiment of Mother Earth. Therefore, managing and protecting Earth's nurturing gifts is our responsibility. The recent global economic collapse, climate change, loss of water and biodiversity, wars, forced displacement, militarization, and violence against women, children, and Mother Earth are clear and unmistakable evidence that the system does not work. Madam Chair, Indigenous women, as the keepers and guardians of much of the world's biodiversity, are alarmed by the ongoing expropriations by seed and pharmaceutical corporations with government complicity to patent the seeds, genetic material, and the processes used in the genetic manipulation of plants. This is genocide against indigenous people. Thus, when it comes to the issue of food sovereignty, we recommend that all United Nations bodies and agencies and governments report on the implementation of Articles 26 and 31 of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples related to the protection of indigenous peoples' rights of lands and territories and their right to own, control, utilize, and protect all aspects of their cultural heritage, including genetic resources, including associated traditional knowledge and trade practices derived from their lands and territories. We request that the Permanent Forum endorse the Atitlan Declaration, which states, food sovereignty is the right of peoples to define their own policies and strategies for the sustainable production, distribution, and consumption of food, with respect for their own cultures and their own systems of managing natural resources. We recommend that United Nations for addressing issues impacting indigenous peoples' right to food sovereignty, such as the FAO, IFAD, and the CBD, report on the processes to protect indigenous peoples' rights to hunt, gather, fish, and carry out their agricultural and other traditional livelihood activities. We call on the agencies to promote capacity building and programs and projects by and for indigenous women, focusing on the recovery and revitalization of food traditions. Fourthly, we recommend that the Permanent Forum request that the parties of the CBD recognize indigenous peoples' rights to our ancestral lands, territories, and waters, including our genetic resources and associated indigenous knowledge. We further recommend that indigenous peoples' rights to free, prior, and informed consent in the operational text of the proposed regime on access and benefit sharing be recognized. We also call for the OHCHR expert mechanism on the rights of indigenous people to examine the human rights implications on the current discourse of ownership of genetic resources and make recommendations to protect the rights of indigenous peoples. We urge the Permanent Forum to demand full and effective participation of indigenous women in any UN forum affecting our rights. We recommend that the Permanent Forum request the appropriate UN bodies and agencies to guarantee indigenous people's right to food sovereignty and food security is not negatively affected by biotechnology. In terms of extractive industries, we support the Anchorage Declaration for phasing out fossil fuel development and a moratorium on new fossil fuel development on or near indigenous lands and territories. We also call upon the Permanent Forum to strengthen interaction with the Special Representative of the Secretary General of Human Rights and transnational corporations and other business enterprises and to facilitate negotiating platforms with affected indigenous peoples, particularly in regard to extractive industries and their impacts on our ways of life, cultures, and on our Mother Earth. We call on the Permanent Forum to cooperate with the Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms of Indigenous Peoples to carry out a broad-based global study on the activities of extractive industries that damage Indigenous peoples, especially Indigenous women. 10. We recommend the creation of an interregional commission on Indigenous peoples to review the activities of the major extractive industries and to report the United Nations Universal Public Periodic Review for each state review. We recommend the nomination of a special rapporteur to prepare a report on the impact of the activities of major extractive corporations on the health of Indigenous women. Cultural resources. We call on all relevant UN bodies and agencies to end the mining and marketing of water and to recognize free access to water as a basic human right. Indigenous peoples have the right to be properly informed in our Indigenous languages and to have meaningful pre-decisional consultation in any development projects. We request an investigation free from conflict of interest, focusing on the negative impacts and effects of water appropriation by multinational corporations from Indigenous communities. We recommend that UNESCO should take an active role in ensuring that access to sacred sites, Genesis sites, and traditional cultural places be protected. We recommend that the Permanent Forum support the preparation of procedural access to the International Court of Justice on the question of projects impacting our lives, tangible and intangible cultural heritage and resource of Indigenous peoples and Mother Earth. This would entail the enforcement of treaties, agreements, and other constructive arrangements between Indigenous peoples and states. Environment. We strongly support and endorse the Anchorage Declaration.
Step the time for the interpreters.
Especialmente los llamados.
Especially the calls for action contained in paragraph 6 and referring to climate change impacting Indigenous peoples, rights, lands, air, ocean, forests, territories, and waters. Madam Chair, to conclude, we have a broader declaration which we are not going to deliver orally given time pressures.
Thank you very much. I would thank you very much. We have extended our time. We ask the indulgence of the interpreter, so we will not be able to call on the ILO this time and the colleagues from the Permanent Forum who want to speak. But tomorrow morning, we will continue with the agenda item, and we will start with the members of the Permanent Forum who will make brief statements, and then the ILO, and then the remaining governments and the Indigenous Peoples Organizations. We will start with Famar Huang Ching and Wilton Little Child. So I think tomorrow morning we will begin the discussion on item 3A of the provisional agenda and then item 3B and item 3C. The Secretariat will make some announcements before we adjourn.
Thank you. I'll have to make them in English because our interpretation already has left. I was asked to make two announcements. The Global Indigenous Peoples Caucus meeting will take place tomorrow, Tuesday, on May 19th at 9 o'clock in the morning in this room. It is imperative that this meeting is well attended to take the opportunity to utilize the costly space. And the second announcement is that North American Regional Indigenous Caucus will meet also tomorrow on Tuesday at 8:30 until 9:45 at the address 777 UN Plaza on the 10th floor. Thank you very much.
This meeting is adjourned. We will meet tomorrow here at 10 o'clock in the same room. Good evening to everybody.